SpaceX goes public, and a Mars mission goes offline. You're listening to Are We There Yet?, the radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. SpaceX made its stock public, launching an initial public offering on Friday, valuing the company at over $2 trillion. It's a huge influx of cash. So how will it affect the space company? Anthony Colangelo covers space industry biz on his podcast, Main Engine Cutoff, and joins us to talk about SpaceX's IPO. Then, a Mars mission has gone dark. The Maven mission studied the Martian atmosphere. NASA lost contact with the satellite late last year and declared it unrecoverable. We'll speak with Maven's principal investigator, Shannon Curry, and NASA's Mike Moreau about the spacecraft's legacy, its contribution to research on the Red Planet. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? Anyone can now invest in SpaceX. SpaceX's initial public offering launched Friday. It's a big move for SpaceX, not only to continue to develop some of its current projects like Starship, but also brings a new wave of people hoping to invest in the company's future. And a ton of cash. From orbital data centers to missions to Mars, this new investment opportunity could help the company reach major milestones. That's according to Anthony Colangelo. He hosts the podcast Main Engine Cutoff and co-hosts the podcast Off Nominal. He joins us now on this podcast to break it all down. Anthony, welcome back to Are We There Yet?
Oh, good to be with you.
We're normally calling on you to talk about space business. What's the gravity of this moment?
2026 is the year that the space nerds have been front and center in front of the world, more so than we have in probably our lifetime collectively, right? Between Artemis II and now SpaceX coming onto the scene in the public manner, it exposes the space industry to a lot of people that don't often think about us. And so, you know, that means new people are entering the industry, new people are reading about the industry. It's going to change some of the conversations that we have amongst ourselves. It's silly to think that we're just still in this little weird corner of space nerds watching rockets launch and land. It's different now. Things are definitely changing.
Yeah, I never thought of it that way. That is interesting. So maybe they'll listen to our podcast more. We'll get more listeners. I barely understand podcast analytics. I definitely don't understand finances. So I'm going to need you to walk me through what an IPO actually is.
So SpaceX for a long time has been one of the most valuable private companies and the most valuable private company in the world that we know about. I mean, there's other asterisks we can apply to that, places we don't know about, whatever. Let's ignore those for now and just simplify the narrative a little bit. So all along their history, they've been taking on investment in different rounds. That rate has been increasing in recent years where they've had a massive need for cash, not only for Starlink, but for Starship development. Now we've learned in this that they spent about $15 billion already in Starship development. During those investment rounds, different investment groups, VC firms, PE firms, all the firms were investing money.
Venture capitalists and private equity.
Sorry to acronym you to death. So every time, you know, that one of those rounds happened, their valuation was based on how much of the percentage of the company they were giving to those investors as part of their investment. So we've seen their valuation grow steeply in the last couple of years. And that's risen to the point at which now when they're going IPO, which means, you know, Gen Pop can buy in. It's not just people with an investment firm anymore, but it is retail investors, retirement accounts, pensions, have had some exposure in the past. Pretty much anyone can go buy SpaceX now if you're able to access one of these markets. So some people will say, well, this is just a way for those early investors to cash out. It is that, but it's also a way for people that were outside to buy in to SpaceX and then see, you know, based on what you believe about their future, it's either a good investment or you might think it's a bad investment, and time will tell.
What's the advantage that SpaceX gets from doing this?
$75 billion.
Okay, that's a pretty big advantage.
Six more Starship development. If I did the math right, I don't know, five or six more Starship development life cycles out of it. So, you know, they are selling off a very small portion of the company in this way. So everybody that's getting an ownership of the company is paying money. That money eventually makes its way to SpaceX. So they have a massive infusion of cash, way bigger than the rounds that they've done previously. You know, you've seen them close rounds in the millions and billions of dollars in the past. This is substantially more than that. So when you think about the kind of investment they're making, not only in Starship, but the other industries that they are either entering or have already entered that are outside of space, sort of, they're space adjacent. You know, they are in this phase where they see the need for a huge infusion of capital to expand infrastructure, to make Starship operations more possible, to deploy orbital data centers in space. I mean, they're going to have to start mining their own natural gas to be able to have enough propellant to fly Starship. The web of what is SpaceX is going to grow a lot, and they need a ton of money to actually do that.
Putting it into that kind of perspective, it's just bonkers to think that just a small amount of this company is garnering $75 billion. What are they going to do with that investment? You alluded a bit to putting it into Starship, but that's not it, right? They're not buying five Starships.
Listen, they could spend $75 billion on Starship for sure if you tempted them. But no, I don't think that's it. You know, SpaceX is getting into developing their own chips because they want to deploy data centers to space. I don't know if you have 6 to 10 hours on the show to go into that thread of what's going on there, but I'm not sure people are really ready for that. SpaceX is going to be competing with, you know, NVIDIA on some terms, which is the most valuable company right now. So the ambition of SpaceX and the markets they're growing into makes them almost unbelievably large in terms of the things they need access to. Like, they need to launch their own satellites, operate their own satellites. Those satellites need to talk back to the ground. That means they need ground stations. To launch those satellites, they need rockets, which need fuel. So they need to go get natural gas. Nobody wants to sell them that much natural gas because no one else needs that much natural gas to fly a vehicle the size of Starship, especially where they're flying it. That gets them into so many different niches of the industry that no other launch company, you know, they're not a launch company. They are a launch company, but they're also all these other industries too. So it is this weird like sci-fi megacorp thing that's hard to really get your mind around.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? From Central Florida Public Media. I'm Brendan Byrne. We're speaking with Anthony Colangelo, host of the podcast Main Engine Cutoff, about SpaceX's IPO and how it might affect the space company. Anthony, other than just this infusion of cash, does this change the way that SpaceX now operates?
There's a lot of things that they're going to have to do now, being public, that they didn't have to before. They're going to have to do quarterly reports. We're going to get more hard numbers on what was going on internally at SpaceX than we have previously. We're going to see more details around where money's going and what is that returning. And they will have to be more open about their plans, which sounds funny for a company that has developed a rocket in a tent accessible by a state road in Texas. Like, to some extent, they were open. They're not open in that way. So this does change some of those operations. It changes a lot for the employees there as well. You know, there's a lot of talk about the equity that these employees are now going to be, that have been around for a while, able to sell to fund either, you know, house purchases, things like that, or honestly, the ones that have been there for a really long time, go fund other companies that they might start. There's a huge amount of capital that's going to the space industry and the nerds that you and I have interviewed for all these years. And we've already seen a lot of them go off and start their own companies. So they probably are elsewhere in the industry, but they still have options in SpaceX or you know, RSUs or wherever it was determined in SpaceX. So there is a lot of capital that's getting infused to the space industry, not just to SpaceX, which is kind of an interesting way to think about it as well.
Yeah, so we're looking at kind of a holistic boost to the space industry here. That's pretty wild. The AI stuff, they need to make their own chips for this, which gives you that sense of scale, as you mentioned. Why is a space company getting involved in AI in the first place?
Yeah, I'm at a weird apex where like half of my life is spent talking about space and the other half is running a software design and development company. So I'm like living the industrial revolution that's happening on one side of my life and then watching the other interest of my life eat that ambition. So I'm actually...
I don't mean to laugh, but...
No, it's...
The way you put it,
it's crazy, man. But I'm here for the storyline. So I think the orbital data center thing, there's a lot of people you can go read about like, well, the radiators aren't going to work. And, you know, this is the problem they're going to need to surmount. But I think my co-host Jake Robbins on Off Nominal had a write-up once that was like, here's the way to look at it. When you deploy a data center on Earth, you need solar panels and chips, and then you need land and utilities and government support and community support. And you need all these things that are outside of your control and getting more expensive. When you deploy one in space, you need solar panels and chips. So that's the same thing you need on Earth. But then you need a launch vehicle and a satellite bus, an ability to communicate back to the ground, a ground station, the ability to refresh those satellites over time. All of the things that SpaceX controls and is getting cheaper, whether or not radiators or orbital deployments or all these other like kind of implementation details, to be honest, the basics of when is this going to be cheaper or more useful in space, I think is trending in an interesting direction. The aspect of global coverage of Starlink is quite interesting to be able to, you know, with low latency, send communications between anywhere on Earth. That's proven useful on a communication side. That is also proven useful probably when you've got data centers up there. So I think my top line is that anywhere we've put computers, they've been really useful. And I think that will continue. I think computers are interesting and useful things for humanity. We tend to find a lot of interesting use cases for them. Any individual use case you might think is a hype cycle. So I wasn't necessarily in on the crypto thing or the NFT thing. I am quite in on the LLM thing. you salt the taste on that. But the end of the day is these are all uses for computers. And if you are a company that wants to make life multiplanetary, for instance, you're going to need a lot of computers out there in space.
I'm reminded of the early conversations and continuing conversations about Starlink going into space and just the sheer number of them and congesting low Earth orbit. Are those conversations being had now? Are there concerns for SpaceX's AI data centers that are going to be also congesting low Earth orbit at a massive scale from what I hear?
Yeah, and it's a different orbit. So space is really big. That's one thing. And there's two aspects I always like to remind people. Space is really big. Imagine if you had 10,000 cars on the surface of Earth. How often would you see a car?
Probably
not,
never.
Not that often. Yeah. And then imagine Earth is way bigger than that, and there are 10,000 cars. How often, you know, so right now, it's not a huge thing. Now, does that infinite defense? No, probably not. The other aspect, though, is that SpaceX is, of all people, the most interested in not ruining the orbit that they operate 10,000 satellites in, right? Like a $2 trillion company now does not want to bring down the thing that makes them the most revenue of their company. They have a more interest in that than you do as somebody who doesn't want to see space littered. They don't want to see that more than you do. Now, where these data centers would go is this sun synchronous orbit. So think about the position of the orbit is kind of static. Some of the astrodynamicists will be mad at me, but static with relation to the sun angle on Earth. So they're talking about putting these in an orbit that is always in sunlight, that doesn't actually have sunrise or sunset in the way that ISS does, which goes around the middle of the Earth. This is a polar orbit that is always in sunlight. So the solar panels can always be generating energy and you can always be operating a computer at full speed, full power, full capacity. Now that's also because of the orbital regime, that is a couple hundred kilometers higher than where Starlink lives. So this is a new orbit. And I bring that up because if there is a problem there, that debris is way longer lived than the Starlink orbit. The Starlink orbit tends to drop down. And if something happens there, drops out of orbit in a matter of days, weeks, sometimes months, up at 800-900 kilometers, that will take centuries to come down. There are definitely different concerns there. That is something that over time, I think, I mean, if their storyline goes well, they will need to manage that over time. But it doesn't feel like a 2026 problem.
Let's talk about what is happening in 2026 for SpaceX and that Starship. The Starship program's already moving forward. What's its next big milestone that we need to look forward to?
So we just had the first flight of the V3 of Starship, which has a huge amount of improvements, better payload mass, a lot of improvements on systems and performance. The trend that you want to see with Starship is good. Flight didn't go perfect. There were some problems that they need to basically fly that flight profile again to make sure that they've got everything dialed in on booster separation and recovery to make sure that they can relight the Raptor engines in space just fine. So the next flight would be kind of a repeat of that last one to make sure that all the fixes they're implementing now go well. And then the flight beyond that, they're talking about going all the way to orbit for the first time, catching the booster again, the newest booster on the newest launch pad. And then from there, the thing that we're watching the most is number one, can they get to orbit, make orbits of Earth return, splash down safely again, as they have had a pretty good track record of doing. But then the orbital refilling angle here is the next most important thing. All of the interesting architectures that Starship can contribute to, you need to be able to launch a Starship, launch another Starship, and refill one with the other so that you can top up the propellant tanks all the way and then fly astronauts to the moon or big heavy satellites to Mars or any other fancy thing that they might want to do.
Lots of stuff to keep an eye on. Anthony Colangelo is the host of the podcast Main Engine Cutoff and co-host of the podcast Off Nominal. Anthony, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Brennan.
Still to come, a look at a Mars mission's legacy.
Ultimately, we want to send humans to Mars. Missions like MAVEN are, you know, not only demonstrating some of the communications infrastructure that's needed, they're also collecting key data about the Martian atmosphere, about the space weather environment at Mars that is important for protecting the astronauts and planning these missions.
NASA's MAVEN mission, why it ended and what we learned. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? You're listening to Are We There Yet? From Central Florida Public Media. I'm Brendan Byrne. Data, it runs the world. But what happens if data is erased or it's lost altogether after natural disaster here on Earth? Well, one option is to send it to space before that can ever happen. Lone Star Data Holdings has launched 4 missions into space, testing their data centers and technology on the International Space Station and on the moon. And soon, this show will head to space, storing data and podcasts off our planet. That's next week on Are We There Yet? But for now, we're talking about MAVEN. In 2023, NASA launched the MAVEN mission to study the atmosphere and environment of Mars. It was only planned to last a year, but the mission survived for more than a decade. But back in December, NASA lost contact with the satellite. After efforts to reach MAVEN failed, the agency officially declared the mission unrecoverable. Here to talk about MAVEN's legacy is Shannon Curry, the principal investigator of the MAVEN mission and the mission's project manager, NASA's Mike Moreau. Shannon, Mike, welcome to Are We There Yet?
Thanks. Great to be here.
Thank you so much.
Mike, before we get into talking about what MAVEN's legacy is, let's talk about what happened to it or what we know happened to it to end this mission.
Well, the MAVEN spacecraft is in orbit about Mars, and occasionally the spacecraft is occulted by Mars. It goes behind Mars and then comes out the other side as the Earth-Mars-Sun geometry progresses. And on December 6th of 2025, we were tracking MAVEN through the Deep Space Network. It passed behind Mars. We lost the signal like you would normally expect. But then when it came out from behind Mars, 20 or so minutes later, there was no signal. And so the team had to start exercising contingency procedures to try to search for a signal and procedures we go through to send commands and try to help reset the spacecraft if it's in a mode that's stuck or something like that. And the team went through all those procedures, but it was ultimately unsuccessful. We continued to search for MAVEN for several months, but in the end, the spacecraft was not recoverable.
Shannon, 11 years operating. I remember covering this mission when it first started, which is, it's wild to think that this has been more than a decade of discovery at Mars. What did MAVEN set out to do? What was its mission goal?
MAVEN's primary goal was to try and understand how the atmosphere has evolved over time. And so we had one primary year to do that, but MAVEN was actually able to continue its science and operations for 11 years. And we're really, really proud of that. We had a lot of great discoveries along the way.
Mike, how challenging is it to send a vehicle to Mars and then keep it operational for more than a decade? It sounds very difficult when you say it out loud.
Well, I mean, there are multiple spacecraft orbiting Mars and operating at Mars right now. And so you might think that it's kind of become a routine thing, but it is very difficult to operate this robotic machine millions of miles away from the Earth, where sometimes the round trip light time is upwards of 30 to 40 minutes, for signals to go round trip. So MAVEN in particular was very challenging because once it got to Mars, it's in this orbit that dips very deep into the atmosphere because it's all about studying the Martian atmosphere and the interaction of the sun with the Martian atmosphere. So that made it difficult for the spacecraft team because as the spacecraft goes through the atmosphere, it's experiencing drag from the particles in the atmosphere. And as the atmosphere varies, that drag varies, and it makes it very hard to predict where the spacecraft is in its orbit over time. So MAVEN was a very challenging mission to operate, and the team was a really phenomenal team that was able to deliver science and keep this mission operating for 11 years and balancing the needs of the science observations with returning data from rovers on the Martian surface, which was another part of the MAVEN mission.
Shannon, you alluded at this, but it was not expected to last 11 years. It sounds like it had a very, very challenging mission. What did you learn?
Oh my goodness, we learned so much. So some of the discoveries that really percolate to the top for me certainly include, we discovered all these different kinds of aurora at Mars. And so the aurora we see here at Earth, some of those don't occur at Mars. And at Mars, there are aurora that don't occur at Earth. If you were an astronaut on the surface, you'd be able to see some of these new kinds of aurora, which we think is just so cool. And there are a lot of reasons that affects the atmosphere. One of the other things we learned was that we think that all these storms coming off the sun that we call space weather were the main thing that eroded that atmosphere over time. Mars used to have a really thick atmosphere and had these huge bodies of liquid water. But then over billions of years, both of those things went away. And so we know that the sun and those huge storms off the sun were mainly responsible for doing a lot of that.
And why is that important to the understanding of Mars? Why do we need to know what happened to its atmosphere? And what are these, really, these auroras matter other than, if one of us gets to go to Mars, we'll get a really cool picture when we're there.
Mars, Venus, and Earth all formed at the same time in pretty similar ways, but then they all evolved really differently. And so understanding what happened to Mars, especially back when it was a habitable planet, it had water, it had a thick atmosphere, it was a lot like Earth. So understanding why it didn't turn out like Earth helps us understand some of our own origins.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? From Central Florida Public Media. I'm Brendan Byrne. We're speaking with Shannon Curry, the principal investigator of the MAVEN mission, and Mike Murrow, NASA's project manager for the mission. Mike, I want to ask you a bit about what it also did down on the surface. You mentioned briefly that MAVEN was helping with the rovers on the ground. What was it doing, and was it set out to do that in the first place?
MAVEN, like some of the predecessors to MAVEN that are orbiting Mars, have carried this radio payload, a relay payload on board that's designed to relay communications from other Mars assets on the ground back to Earth. And so that was a really important part of the MAVEN mission, was relaying some of the data that was collected by the Curiosity rover and the Perseverance rovers on the surface of Mars and previous assets that were there before that. So it's actually a really important legacy of the MAVEN mission is all of the data that was returned from those rovers as well. And, you know, that infrastructure that exists there now with there are three other orbiters around Mars that will continue to provide that relay service. You know, that's just the beginning of what's ultimately needed to support more exploration of Mars. As we talk about sending more robotic spacecraft there, as we talk about sending humans there in the future, there'll need to be a more dedicated infrastructure for communications. But right now, we've relied on these science spacecraft with this extra relay payload to provide that service, to get that scientific data back.
I find it so fascinating to hear that there are at least, you know, three satellites orbiting another planet that we are using to discover that planet. It's pretty wild to think about that. Shannon, aside from what MAVEN did, you know, helping those rovers and understanding the atmospheric conditions and what happened to it, I was reading that it also did some observations of things like comets too. Can you tell us a bit about what MAVEN did looking outward?
Absolutely. So MAVEN has all these really cross-divisional science activities as well. And so one of them was Comet 3I Atlas. I think a lot of folks know Comet 3I was an interstellar comet, meaning it came from outside the solar system, which is so wild.
Mm-hmm.
And so when
rare, right? We don't get these very often.
Very, very rare. It's like, I mean, for us, literally, it's once in a mission.
Yeah.
Often once in a lifetime a chance to do this. We were so excited to be able to participate. So one of the things we did was that we developed a whole campaign so that during the closest approach to Mars, we would turn all of our instruments around. And rather than look at Mars, we would actually look at the comet. And we got gorgeous images. Personally, I think we got the best view of the comet of really any of our spacecraft. And so it was so incredible to be able to image it, and not just image it, but find some of the things like how much water there was and some of the constituents, like what the comet was made of. And so we had a terrifyingly great view of the comet as it went by Mars.
Mike, these seem like kind of, you know, technical marvels when you think about, you know, relaying data from the surface of Mars. What are some of the technical things that you learned from the MAVEN mission that maybe apply to future planetary orbiters?
You know, as we operate these missions, we're always learning things that we can apply to future missions. You know, I think one of them is simply how to operate these missions more efficiently. You know, so as MAVEN went on, we learned to do more and more challenging things with the spacecraft, with the team that we had, and sometimes reducing the size of the team that it took to operate the spacecraft and continuing to do these things. So that's something that then applies to all of the other missions that are in our fleet. You know, these operators can take those skills forward. But, you know, in particular, I think we're learning things at Mars that are laying the foundation for the ambitious objectives that the NASA has for exploration. So you're hearing about the Artemis program and sending astronauts back to the moon. Ultimately, we want to send humans to Mars. Missions like MAVEN are, you know, not only demonstrating some of the communications infrastructure that's needed, they're also collecting key data about the Martian atmosphere, about the space weather environment at Mars that is important for protecting the astronauts and planning these missions and executing these missions. So a lot of the scientific return of the mission directly helps for these future missions that of exploration we want to do at Mars and other places as well.
Mike knows this, and most of us are used to it, but, you know, MAVEN does actually hold the record, the solar system record for the largest relay of all time. So it was like north of 2.4 gigs. And for in in deep space, that's a really incredible record to hold. And we're really proud to hold the solar system record as of now on how much data we could return from the rovers and in our own spacecraft.
That's bonkers to think of, too, because it takes something like 20 months to physically get there, but you're able to transfer 2 gigs back somehow. So, man, that is absolutely wild.
That was just one relay session, too. So
just one? Oh, wow. That's fantastic. That leads me to one of the questions I like to ask. I like to ask like these kind of mundane questions about space flight. But how would you get that data? Would Mike like send you an email and say, here's a link to 2 gigabytes of data that just came back from your mission at Mars?
No, it goes through quite a few steps. Really what happens is that data is sent down, effectively radiated down to something called the DSN. That's the Deep Space Network. The Deep Space Network carves up which part is ours, and then it sends it over to Lockheed Martin. And so Lockheed Martin down in Littleton, they take it apart more for us, and then they send it to the science team, and then we go nuts with it. And I also get an email from Mike saying, here you go, you're welcome.
Hey, check your data. I'm going to go back to that two gig relay, Mike. How were you able to pull it off? What is it kind of transmitting? How is it doing that?
This all has to be highly scheduled in advance. So they're predicting when the Maven spacecraft is going to be above a place on Mars where one of the rovers is located. And that opens up a window of time when the spacecraft's passing overhead, when you can start this communications link. And so the rovers will have this planned in their schedule. Maven will have this planned in its schedule. And it all happens autonomously, where the communications from the rover makes a link with the spacecraft. The spacecraft then gets that data on board and transmits it to Earth. And one of the things that made Maven particularly suited for doing these relays is it was in an orbit that passed very close by Mars on one side of its orbit, but it was high above the surface of Mars in the other part of its orbit. So it kind of had these long passes over parts of the planet that helped it be a great communications asset.
It's just a radio frequency that it's sending back?
Yeah, it's actually a UHF radio that is the link from the surface of Mars to the spacecraft.
It's only 13 megabytes for a full Are We There Yet show. So I'm kind of upset we didn't try to sneak one in while it was sending stuff back to it. Shannon, I'm going to give you the last word here. What do you think Maven's lasting legacy will be?
Maven really helped us understand why Mars went from this habitable world to the drier, arid planet it is today. And I think we've discovered so many things about how atmospheres evolve and how atmospheres work. We can take this knowledge and apply it to so many other planets in our solar system and beyond.
Shannon Curry is the principal investigator of the Maven mission. Michael Morrow is NASA's project manager for the mission. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks. It was great to be with you.
Well, that's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Stay connected with this show. Be sure to follow us on social media. You can find us on Instagram and Facebook. We're at @AWTYSpace. If you've got an idea for a future episode of this show, or you want to join us as a guest, reach out. We're at arewethereyet@cfpublic.org. Are We There Yet is a production of Central Florida Public Media. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Editorial guidance comes from LaToya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.